Welcome to Oncology Today, key presentations from the 2022 ASH meeting on myeloproliferative neoplasms. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Sir John Verstovsek from the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. And to begin, I asked him to provide an overview of myeloproliferative neoplasms.
When we talk about MPNs, we talk about classic Philadelphia chromosome negative MPNs, and that is essential thrombocythemia, polycythemia vera, and myelofibrosis. Myelofibrosis is the deadliest, and we talk a lot about it because of shorter life expectancies than normal, and focus on quality of life and control of the spleen and anemia, for example, rather than prolongation of life. And so that's the key parameter here for me to try to elevate the bar with the novel agents, not only to do more of the spleen or anemia or symptom control, but also to control the disease signs, symptoms for as long as possible to make people live longer. We don't have a cure with medications. Only cure is a transplant, and less than 10% of patients get there. So all the medications aim to improve what we do, but not that many, really, and only one in reality, aims to say, hey, I'm going to make you live longer. We do have good evidence from the past that controlling the signs and symptoms, making spleen smaller or improving quality of life, people gain weight and participate regularly in what otherwise life is, actually make people live longer. But that is still something that is not in the eyes of drug developers or FDA. But in ET and PV, the situation is completely different because life expectancy is close to normal. And in that sense, the intent of current therapy is to decrease the possibility of having some side effect from uncontrolled blood cell count, which leads to clotting. And that blood clot leads to untimely death or morbidity associated with the condition. And the more of the effort is, as you will see today through discussion, on getting to the next step. If the next step in the myelofibrosis is complete response or life prolongation with a good control of signs and symptoms, the next step in ET and PV is the molecular response. A molecular response would mean decrease or elimination of detectable JAK2 mutation or calreticulin mutation in ET, which would then logically to me lead to less of a, not only blood clotting, but less of a risk of a progression to myelofibrosis or acute myeloleukemia, which happens in a good proportion of these patients with ET and PV, and which is the most scary issue with the management of particularly younger patients with ET and PV, which by default should have a good life expectancy, but can progress and then die, right? So the many patients with ET and PV are very concerned about the progression. And if we can aim for molecular response, which is tied to decreasing or eliminating progression, then that would be a success, and that's where we are going forward with the new discoveries, as you will see today when you talk what's new from ASH 2022.
Any sort of myths or misperceptions that you see? I know you see a lot of second opinions of patients who've been managed in the community in terms of how people particularly approach a myelofibrosis.
Unfortunately, I have a continuous feeling over the last 10 plus years since the ruxolitinib, the first JAK inhibitors have been approved, and now we have two other ones approved, fedratinib and pacritinib, that the perception of their utility is still bound only to making people feel good and nothing else. And there is plenty of evidence that we can actually, as I alluded to briefly, with a good control of the signs and symptoms, and with ruxolitinib in particular, making spleen as small as possible, we can make people live longer. With the combinations that are in pipeline, we can perhaps optimize the care and make them really live much, much longer. That's my hope with the combinations, not only to say, hey, your spleen is a little bit smaller or you feel a little bit better, but that that control will translate to a durability and longevity of the patients. So the idea of not eliminating disease, we don't eliminate disease, but still making people live longer, it's hard to impress on the local hematologists, oncologists in a community setting because it's not normal, right? We usually talk about CR and PR, and that means longer life. Not here. We don't have medications to achieve CR and PR. We're talking clinical improvement, and yet people can live longer. So optimizing the care to make that control of the disease, signs and symptoms, so good to make people live longer is what I would like to impress even today during this discussion. How to do that? What's the optimal care and what's the goal? It's not only feeling better. It is also living longer with good quality of life.
That's a really interesting point. You know, I guess the perception that a lot of people have is that most of the our ability to help people live longer has to do with sort of relieving symptoms and improving performance status. You know, out there is also the hope that the disease process underlying it can be modified, particularly with some of the new agents. How does a doc know whether or not they're really approaching this optimally or not? Is the goal to make the patient completely asymptomatic? Do you look at their weight? How can a physician taking care of a patient, you know, sort of line themselves up to try to maximize the patient's survival?
I would extend this to include two points. One is to optimize the dose of, if we talk, for example, with about ruxolitinib, to make the dose as good as possible to decrease the spleen as much as possible, knowing that the higher dose means smaller the spleen, and there are multiple different reports associating the small spleen with a much better durability and the longevity of that patient. So stepping up from making just people feel good and saying, okay, your spleen is smaller and it's not symptomatic anymore, to thinking, hey, it's smaller, but can I make it as small as possible? Because it will take much longer for this spleen to come back, and you will enjoy your life much longer if that spleen as small as possible. And you don't need a CAT scan or MRIs for that. You just do it by palpation and optimize those to the highest safe dose. There are evidence of some similar benefits from other JAK inhibitors, fedratinib, or even some experimental medications that possibly can extend life by controlling that sign and symptoms. And perhaps for other medications, there will be other sign other than the spleen response as a marker for longevity and durability. The other part is, when do we need to intervene to get the best out of it, right? I remember the time when ruxolitinib was approved in 2011, when they say, oh, it's a palliative care. It's for those that go to hospice and nothing else to do. And then we learned that it can possibly extend life for a few years, 3 years on average in clinical studies, and people start thinking about earlier intervention. But thinking is not really what the standard practice at the moment is. There is, again, from the past experience from the clinical studies and from the community setting as well, a good evidence these days that earlier intervention, meaning less sick patients and a shorter duration from the diagnosis to intervention, make a lot of difference for the patients. I can't explain it all why, but one parameter certainly is that less sick patients have less of anemia, less thrombocytopenia, smaller spleen, and perhaps not that extraordinary bad quality of life. And when you intervene in that setting, you're going to get much better control, right, of those parameters, and it will be easier because you're not going to have a problem with anemia and thrombocytopenia that compromise the delivery of JAK inhibitors, ruxolitinib and fedratinib, for example. That's one parameter. And then, of course, timing also is related to perhaps, and you will see in some presentation we're going to talk about it, less of a genetically complicated disease, which would be amenable then to much better response to a JAK inhibitor. Because, well, and that's, I think, is logical. When you have a multi-clonal disease, multiple genetic abnormalities in the patients with myeloproliferative neoplasms, which is quite common with myelofibrosis, and acquisition of new mutations over time is normal natural evolution of myelofibrosis, then getting people on a JAK inhibitor when there are multiple mutations and clones is not going to work as well. So biologically and clinically, it makes sense to intervene early with the goal to get much better results, which will last much longer, and people will then enjoy life for a few extra years.
Again, sort of looking at what you're seeing out there in the community, can you talk a little bit about how you approach the patient with anemia that you're starting out on therapy, and also the patient with thrombocytopenia? And, you know, again, some of the pearls that you have incorporated in your practice that maybe you might want to share with docs out in the community.
Anemia and thrombocytopenia are problematic. They compromise the delivery of ruxolitinib. They compromise the delivery of fedratinib to some degree. But luckily, since about a year ago, we have a new agent called pacritinib that is approved specifically for patients with low platelets. And that means platelets below 50, for which neither ruxolitinib nor fedratinib should be given. If they are given, they're not really effective because they're usually given at very low dose. So pacritinib is quite novel for us, a JAK inhibitor that can control the sinus symptoms, spleen and symptoms in people with low platelets without further worsening that platelet number. NCCN guidelines even suggest the pacritinib to be a choice regardless of the what platelet number is in a second-line setting. If you use, let's say, ruxolitinib or fedratinib in a first-line setting, what do you do in second-line setting? You can use either one, ruxolitinib or fedratinib, but in this setting, many people are actually thrombocytopenic, many. And then pacritinib should be used regardless, really, whether platelets are 50 or not. And it's very useful in that setting. So we covered what we call area of unmet need, patients with low platelets with the development of pacritinib. And you will see today's presentation, there is also a sense that it may actually, in some patients, 20-25% of patients, also improve the anemia, which would be quite valuable for these people with such a low blood count. We call these cytopenic patients. Not to get to that level where you really need to worry about anemia and thrombocytopenia so much is what I was saying earlier on, earlier intervention in frontline setting with the drugs that do cause anemia, thrombocytopenia, ruxolitinib or fedratinib, with the goal to help the patients earlier on, and then it will be easier to manage for much longer. Now, everybody eventually will fail, but if you do the frontline setting in a much better way, that frontline setting will work for much longer, and then you get to the second line where you again need to do something different for people with cytopenia like a pacritinib. So I would like improvements on all aspects. Better frontline setting in an easier way with the earlier intervention, with better doses that will last longer, and then a second line setting with the new medications that that are being developed or that are approved will also extend that life of myelofibrosis patients.
How would you compare the effect of pacritinib in the patient with anemia to momelotinib?
Momelotinib is quite an interesting drug. It has been in a clinical development for a very long period of time. It was compared to ruxolitinib in frontline setting, head-to-head in blinded way, equal control of the spleen, very interestingly. And the symptoms were not as well controlled as was with ruxolitinib. That's why the study failed, although in a subsequent analysis, there was also evidence of a good control of anemia. This is another drug that possibly can improve the anemia through different mode of action. We're going to talk about this a little bit later. But because that study was unsuccessful in control of the symptoms, it was not approved. Further studies were done. And the latest study called Momentum study was comparing the momelotinib to danazol in a second-line setting for symptomatic and anemic patients. Not that spleen was the primary or key secondary endpoint anymore. It was redesigned studies to prove the point that momelotinib is good for anemia and symptoms, and it was. And we expect that drug to be approved for anemic patients by summer next year. And your question then is very important. If we have already pacritinib that can be given to patients with low platelets and appears to be improving anemia in some, and now you have a new drug where you can improve the anemia and symptoms, and it can be given in people with low platelets as well, you have overlap, of course. The judgment call between the two drugs in terms of which one to use will be in the eyes of the treating doctor. What is the main problem? Is it the low platelets preventing to control the spleen and symptoms, where pacritinib will be probably a number one choice? Or is it really just anemia? And in that setting, the momelotinib will be the choice. And there are a lot of patients in a second setting with different clinical scenarios or presentations where there would be place for both. I am happy, actually, that we have choices. One can even think about one after the other. Why not? To extend that control of the sinus symptoms for as long as possible. So there is little overlap, but I'm not that worried about it. Look, too many is never bad.
So one other issue I want to bring up before we get into the papers, and that is management of the patient who's progressing or who you think is progressing. And let's just focus on ruxolitinib for now. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach that? First, how you determine that the patient is having disease progression, and then how you manage patients in that situation. Do you generally continue treatment anyhow? Do you overlap the treatment, say ruxolitinib, with the next treatment? How do you manage these patients?
Progression from therapy with the ruxolitinib, which is typical first choice for control of the spleen and symptoms, may manifest itself in different ways. And I typically say three different ways. One is that after some time of good response of spleen and symptoms, with the required dose adjustments for anemia or thrombocytopenia, as we discussed, the patient after, let's say, a year, 2 years, or 3 years, slowly starts to worsen the anemia or thrombocytopenia. We don't really know why. You may have a genetic component there with acquisition of new mutations or some other reasons, but that's one evidence of loss of response. So what do you do? Well, patient still feels better with the symptoms and the spleen, but you would have a need for possible adjustment of ruxolitinib, which will lead to a loss of control of the spleen and symptoms eventually. So you add another drug on top of ruxolitinib, right? You would add anemia drug. And by the way, in a phase 3 randomized study, at the moment, we have a luspatercept, which I'm sure you're familiar as a drug for MDS, for anemia in some patients with MDS, where we have that in the clinical phase 3 blinded study for possible approval in such a patients who are doing relatively well on ruxolitinib but require transfusions with the goal to eliminate transfusions. NCCN guidelines already lists luspatercept as a possibility of prescribing to myelofibrosis for people who suffer from anemia, and particularly in this type of progression, quote unquote. If luspatercept is not available and of course is not approved, we would add danazol or ESAs on prednisone, try to counteract the anemia because anemia worsens and then it leads to a decrease in the dose of ruxolitinib and you lose the control of everything. And then you say, what do I do now? The second problem is progressive in the spleen. Here again, you would add rather than replace. And we call this add-on approach. You would add cytoreduction therapy, but this is the prime example where we need new drugs. So you have studies which are being done with the goal, a number of them, phase 3 studies where you add another agent to ruxolitinib in order to improve the spleen and symptom control. And the number 3 area is where the blasts go up, right? The patient is progressing to acute myeloid leukemia, which is the case in about 25% of patients. There are not that many studies in this area, although it's a substantial group of people, about a quarter. Standard practice, however, is not that bad, has a good track record. This is to add hypomethylation agents, which are very useful. I would say half and half chance to decrease the blast and transition patients to the transplant. And these days, we also test for genetic abnormalities. 20 to 25% of the patients, when they are progressing like that, that's called accelerated blastic phase, when the blasts go up, they acquire IDH mutations. And of course, IDH inhibitors are out there. And we are successfully using in those patients that are progressing in terms of blasts going up with the IDH mutation acquisition, IDH inhibitors to, again, control the progression, go back to chronic phase, and transplant them. So the main, among all these problems, the main problem is cytopenias. A loss of control because of the anemia and thrombocytopenia. That comes up usually, particularly anemia, as the number one reason why you eventually stop the ruxolitinib. Now, because of a variety of clinical scenarios, there are no very good definitions for use of different drugs, when and what to do. It does come down to a lot of experience that one needs to have to recognize when to intervene and how to modify. And I'm happy here to help. As you said, a lot of patients come through the door, about 4 or 5 new patients in consultations every week with myelofibrosis, most of them with some issues, either already failing frontline or on a frontline setting without problems, where we try to help and include them in many clinical studies as well.
The IDH, I never heard of that. That's really interesting. So yeah. Have you actually seen patients benefit from IDH inhibition? I saw there's a second in AML, there's a new IDH1 inhibitor. I didn't even know. Never heard about it. It just got approved, actually. I don't know if there's any difference between that and the ones we have, but you've actually seen patients benefit.
Oh, yes. And we and others have published. Of course, the number of patients is relatively low, because if the quarter of myelofibrosis patients progress and quarter of them have IDH mutations, then of course the group is small, but it really works very well. You have some publications out there, about three or four. Even from our own group, we had like 12 patients, and another group in Chicago had eight, and so on. But a majority of the patients would get to the CR or CRI by adding the IDH inhibitor on top, typically, of hypomethylation agents. And you can keep going with the JAK inhibitor as well at the same time to control that inflammation and the spleen. So it really works very well, but it's not forever, of course, like in any other acute myeloid leukemia setting, but it gives you an opportunity to get patients to the transplant.
And you see IDH1 and 2?
Yes.
And do you see differentiation syndrome?
Well, from my experience, now we have probably up to 20 patients, one or two cases, not too often. You have still people on JAK inhibitor, you have them on hypomethylation agents. Perhaps JAK inhibition is controlling that myeloproliferation.
Really interesting. Okay, well, let's talk about what happened at ASH. I'm just kind of curious, before you get started, as you were heading towards ASH, I'm curious what the papers were that you were most interested in seeing. When you look back, is there kind of one area that, you know, sort of stood out this year of all the papers that you were about to go through?
A lot of that I said is covered by different presentations, and we have here to talk about variety through different diseases and different stages. The one that really caught my eye, also caught an eye of the reviewers associated with American Society of Hematology. There was a plenary session at ASH that included MPN report. I didn't even look up the plenary session because that's not normal. I would not expect anything to get to that level. And surprise, it was the preliminary preclinical result of the new agent in development, which is the calreticulin antibody. And we'll talk about this when I go through the slides. But briefly, about a third of the patients with the myelofibrosis or ET have a mutation in that gene called calreticulin. Everybody knows usually about JAK2V617F, right? 60% of MF, 60% of ET, 100% almost of PV have that mutation. But 30% of ET and 30% of MF have a calreticulin mutation. Well, what does this do? The mutated protein, and I'll show you some cartoons, is excreted from the cell, and it attaches itself, a mutated protein, attaches itself from outside to the receptor for thrombopoietin called MIPL. That's the receptor for the growth factor for platelets, and that's how activate the JAK-STAT pathway. Well, it's on the surface of the cell. So it's recognizable by the immune system, perhaps, and also it's then amenable to development of specific drugs. Calreticulin-specific antibody was the topic of that plenary session, and I'll tell you about it because the potential is to eliminate, of course, malignant cells in a specific way. We don't have any drug like that at all.
I can't wait to hear that one. I'm waiting for you to tell me there's going to be CAR T or bispecific also.
Yeah, I think this is where the field is going finally. Of course, then we're going to talk about how much clinical benefit actually this is going to provide. Because we just talked about it, this is a genetically complicated condition, myelofibrosis. Multiple other clones may be existing. So we'll come to that and perhaps have a nice discussion at that slide section.
Awesome. All right, well, let's get started.
Very good. So thank you again for having me on the program. I enjoy a lot discussions with you, and hopefully this will be useful also from the listeners here. And of course, any of the slides are open to discussion. But now that we had this lovely introduction, it will be easier to grasp what I chose here for discussion today. So molecular characterization of response and loss of response to ruxolitinib. Why? Because if we have these driver mutations, JAK2 mutation, calreticulin mutation, and that's a third one, MIPL mutation, that covers 90% of the patients in terms of being reason for a hyperactivity of JAK-STAT pathway. There are other mutations. There may be other clones that are genetically different. And in that setting, the question was whether the genetic complexity at the beginning or during the therapy or combination of the two would impact on the outcome of the patients. And we already have some reports in the past that that's the case. Not only that the clinical picture of the patient determines what happens with the patients on therapy, but also genetic background. And here is the baseline variables associated with the spleen response. To the left, you have a transfusion dependency as a bad factor for response, and the dose of ruxolitinib in green as a good factor for response. Remember, we talked about it. If you have advanced patients with an anemic already, ruxolitinib cannot be given well because it's causing more of anemia. So this obviously goes along the line what we said. The earlier intervention with patients are not so anemic or thrombocytopenic would optimize their care, and the dose of ruxolitinib, higher dose, the better overall response. That's just logical from what we just discussed. You have then molecular profile to the right, and it says that the RAS pathway mutations, 10 to 15% of the patients like that, these are really not going to respond much at all. Now, why? I don't think we have a good understanding why is that happening. But this is just a confirmation of some other reports in the past. And how can we predict who is going to lose the response sooner rather than later? Because I tell you, everybody responds to some degree, but some respond for 6 months and some for 3.5 years. So one parameter, in addition to normal baseline clinical characteristics of patients, is again the genetic information. So to the left, you see older people, those that are anemic, in red color to the left, are not going to do well for too long. Ruxolitinib dose, again, the higher the dose, the longer the control of the disease. And to the right, you have a genetic information. If the driver mutations allele burden goes down over time, and we cannot predict who will have that or not, for some reason, some patients actually have a molecular response. It's the JAK2 allele burden is going down. They will do well. And high molecular risk state, there are specific mutations, ASXL1, EZH2, SRFS1, and IDH mutations. If they are present, the patient is not going to do well. So genetic background, in addition to clinical scenario, makes a difference for the overall outcome of the patients. And that's why I usually advocate, that's a good reason why, start early, right? Not so sick and not so genetically complicated. Now, the other drug that is approved for frontline setting in patients with platelets above 50 and can be given in the second line setting as well, as it's in NCCN guidelines, is fedratinib. Fedratinib has expectations of the same type of response in frontline setting as with ruxolitinib, same anemia and thrombocytopenia side effects, but it's a little bit more complicated, as you will see also in these slides, because it does cause in 2/3 of patients some GI irritation, and it can inhibit the uptake of thiamine into the body of the patients, which then can cause very rarely Wernicke encephalopathy. Now, this particular result is from the FREEDOM study that was just finished. That was the open label, a phase 3b study in the United States to give us more information about fedratinib in the second line setting after ruxolitinib. And you can see top line response in the table is 25.7, so 26% of the patients responding by 35% volumetric reduction in spleen, which is about half by population. Very good response, and not as good as in frontline setting, about 40+%, but second line is never good as frontline, and it's pretty good. If you scroll down to the symptomatic improvement at the bottom of the table, that is 50% reduction in symptoms. TSS means total symptom score. Majority of the patients feel better. Very good results. So it is full-fledged, very good choice in a second-line setting for people that don't do well on ruxolitinib. But it's not for everybody. Not for everybody in second-line setting. Not only that you have a little of constipation, diarrhea, and nausea, which is the gastrointestinal disorder first-line here in the table problem, which you have to manage with antidiarrheal and anti-nausea medications, but also anemia and thrombocytopenia still happen to the same degree as it is with ruxolitinib. That's second line in this table. And so my message here is fedratinib is good in second line setting for people who are not anemic and thrombocytopenic. That's about 1/4 of the patients in the second line setting. It's not for everybody. If you just give it to somebody who is failing ruxo because of anemia, it's just going to make it worse, right? So you have to think who is a good candidate for fedratinib, and you need to give people anti-nausea, anti-diarrheal medication, and monitor that thiamine level, which is not on the table, give it timing or measure timing because you don't want to have any central nervous system toxicity. If you manage patients well with antidiarrheal and anti-nausea medications, this is what happens. It is not as common. Diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting are listed here from cycle 1 to cycle 6. With prophylactic preventative GI medications, you will have fewer patients experiencing it, and it will go away slower. So there would be no reason to stop fedratinib. You will give a good chance for fedratinib to work because it does need a few months to work. The fedratinib can be used in a second-line setting not only for kind of a salvage of the patients who are not doing well with ruxolitinib, but also to reinstitute the response to a degree where you can make patients eligible for the transplant as well. We typically, and this is a really important slide actually, we typically would say to the patients when we start initial therapy with ruxolitinib, you should go to the transplant when you are in best possible shape, because it may not last forever. You feel good after a few months, and the transplant has been proven to be the best when the patient's in the best physical condition, right? The control of the inflammation and proliferation is optimal. You should go for it. But that doesn't happen, I tell you. In every practice, people say, patients, why would I do it now? I feel so much better. I gain a few pounds. My spleen is smaller. And then people wait. And I agree with that. I agree with that, but it's not that easy situation. What's your view on that particular issue?
I'm curious what you say to patients. I'm sure some of your patients, you know, you might have medical oncologists who are patients, but for people who want the information, I'm curious what you say about the risks and benefits of transplant, the outcomes that you see with transplant when they contemplate this very difficult decision, both the downsides as well as the upsides, the chance for cure.
You know, this is really important, so important aspect of what we do. We know that the transplant is the only way that we can cure the patients. And we have always said, you should do the transplant right away. Now, with ruxolitinib, as an example, you get people to feel better. They say, I don't want to do it right now. And so people wait. And so the art here is to judge when you see this loss of control of the signs and symptoms and then say, okay, you see, anemia is worsening or spleen is coming back. Let's do it now. So you prepare the patient. You don't wait. And the patient is educated and part of the team. And you can then easily transition without really having full-fledged loss of control when the patient is in bad shape again. That's where the transplant needs to happen if it's not right away. And what happens many times, and I have seen it, unfortunately, in my own clinic, patients wait and say, I still feel good. And I say, but you are losing response. And the patient is waiting and then it's sick. And the transplant is not an option. Well, then you can possibly use fedratinib, as it's here, after ruxolitinib to regain control of the spleen and symptoms and do the transplant right there when the patients feel good. So it is a little bit of an art to say when is the best time. And some data actually showed, particularly from Princess Margaret Hospital in Canada, I really applaud Canadians for doing a good job in following patients very well, that there is a group of people that do so well on ruxolitinib, you should not transplant them right away. They may be on ruxolitinib for 5 to 10 years and do so well. And why would you do the transplant right away in those super responders when they can die from the transplant right away? So this is debate here. When is the best time? And it has to be individualized.
What do you generally estimate nowadays to be the mortality risk with transplant? And what do you tell people to expect in terms of quality of life over the next couple of years after that?
Well, I'm optimistic by nature. So I say overall general mortality rate is somewhere in 20-25% range. Of course, the older or sicker you are, it goes up. If younger and healthier, it's going down. And the one variable that I know, and I can't really go into detail because I'm not a transplanter, but I follow from outside, that the experience and the site where you do it matters, right? So it is not the same. Unfortunately, that's not illogical, right? That the transplant outcome is different in the smaller academic centers or more experienced when it comes to myelofibrosis transplant specifically. Experience counts, the way that you have support, the way that the pre-transplant preparation is, everything does count. And I would suggest typically my patients to go to the very experienced large center for myelofibrosis transplant specifically. You asked me in the past about pacritinib. Approved for patients with lower platelets below 50 for control of the spleen. Of course, it will improve the quality of life. In NCCN guidance, listed as a choice for people with low counts, regardless of the platelet number in second-line setting. And I mentioned briefly this particular novelty, if you like. ACVR1, what is the ACVR1? This is the marker on the surface of the hepatocytes that is important for iron metabolism. You inhibit ACVR1, you will decrease hepcidin in the body of the patients. And hepcidin is very high as inflammatory marker in the patients of myelofibrosis. And by decreasing hepcidin, you would decrease the inflammation further and allow iron to be available for erythropoiesis. We're going to touch upon that a little bit later again when we talk about momelotinib, because that's the primary way of how clinical benefit of momelotinib, anemia benefit, is supposed to happen through inhibition of ACVR1. Now, with pacritinib, we knew already in the past that there are patients that improve red blood cell count. And so here is the old publication from some years ago. You see the bars. Pacritinib 200 milligrams twice a day. That's how it should be given in PERSIST-2 study. PERSIST-2 study was patients with platelets below 100, everybody, first line, second, and all mixed. You see that 25% of patients improved the anemia. So what is novel is that it was associated with this inhibition of ACVR1, which would decrease the hepcidin again and make iron more available for terminal erythropoiesis, like anti-chronic disease anemia type of therapy. So more specific analysis of type of responses was provided at ASH. Again, quarter of the patients improving, and you see in different subgroups of patients, not to go to the detail, to the right side, you see that 20-25% improvement in anemia, clinically relevant. So I do tell my patients that you will experience a degree of spleen reduction with pacritinib, feeling better, and there is a chance for anemia to improve as well. The approval was accelerated for pacritinib. At the moment, there is this study underway globally for further support of the complete approval of pacritinib. That's a Pacifica study, a phase 3 randomized study of pacritinib versus physician choice of therapy in people with platelets below 50 for control of the spleen. There is no mentioning of anemia benefit on the label of pacritinib, but it's very useful to know about it from what I just said. So this particular study is underway outside United States for confirmation of the spleen response versus BAT. And so this gives us a chance then to transition to Momentum phase 3 study of momelotinib. You're asking about that? Well, I'm very excited about having more choices. And this one is different than the others. They are all in a JAK2, that's a JAK2 inhibitor, all in that JAK2 group, but they are different, as you can see, even by discussion so far. This was a blinded randomized study, momelotinib versus danazol, as you see in symptomatic and anemic patients in the second line setting. So the design is in upper part, simple, straightforward, separation of symptomatic anemic patients between momelotinib and placebo, danazol versus placebo. And the result is summarized in the lower part of the table, in the table. So if you look in the table to the left, you have TSS. This is the first result. Total symptom score, remember that's a half of the symptoms gone. MMB is the momelotinib, about 25% response rate, 24.6 to be precise, versus danazol, which is anabolic steroid. We usually give it for symptoms and anemia. So it's a valid control. If you go from the left to the right in the table, you have transfusion independence response. That's the key. Transfusion independence. So no more transfusions. 30% versus 20% of danazol. You may say, well, some, but I'll give you more data on that. That's very intriguing. And finally, in the table to the right, it's an SRR spleen response, 23% in a second setting. Remember, fedratinib was 27. It's about the same. So it can control the symptoms and anemia and the spleen as well. And because this drug does not really have too much myelosuppression, right? The anemia actually gets improved. The platelets do not change much. And you alluded to this in your questions at the beginning. there is a possibility of overlap in the future. If momelotinib gets approved by June, as we expect in the United States, what you're going to be doing between the pacitinib and momelotinib? Well, difficult to say. It's not black and white, but there is a result here. You can see it right here of momelotinib improving spleen symptoms and in transfusion independence in patients, basically regardless of the platelet number. From the left to the right, we have a first group is platelets, patients with platelets below 150, in the middle below 100, to the right below 50. The blue is always momelotinib, always better with than danazol. So you can envision that in anemic patients with low platelets, you can give the momelotinib for improvement of anemia. And this anemia benefit is long-lasting. Before I go to the next slide, it's long-lasting, and the dosing of momelotinib is very simple. There are no real major problems. Almost everybody, 96% of patients, stay on momelotinib without any dose adjustments. Of course, it's not going to work forever, but there was a presentation in ASH suggesting that those patients that become transfusion independent may actually live longer. If we have a spleen as a marker of longevity with ruxolitinib, perhaps here we have a marker of transfusion independence as a marker for longevity with momelotinib. Much more to learn from momelotinib over the next 6 months before and if it gets approved. But exciting time, particularly for patients in second-line setting, as you can see. Now, if we are talking about optimizing the care as we did so far from the day one, then there are options here that are in clinical development where you would add another agent to ruxolitinib in people who have lost control of the spleen and symptoms. Parsaclisib is the PI3 kinase delta inhibitor, which is being studied, as you can see, in people who are on ruxolitinib but have a suboptimal response in terms of a spleen and symptom control. Phase 3 study, randomizing patients who are on ruxolitinib with symptoms and spleen still to some degree between pelabresib and placebo, is underway. This is what you can expect from that drug. You have here a spleen response to the left after 12 weeks of therapy. These are classic waterfalls that you see, and to the right, a 24-week response. In this setting, the green color is the dose that is the best, obviously. The green is the 5 milligrams daily continuously, easy to give, and the best result in this setting. So you see about response rate is about 28% response rate by judging a quarter of the spleen gone. These people are already responding to ruxolitinib, so they are suboptimal responders. You don't need to judge the efficacy of a new drug by going a half of the spleen gone, which is a 35% volumetric reduction. 25% volumetric reduction is enough. So it's valuable, and phase 3 study is underway. It also improved the symptoms as well.
I wanted to ask you, I don't know whether other people find it confusing, but you hear about PI3 kinase inhibition and breast cancer. You hear about lymphomas. A lot of the agents that are used, particularly in breast cancer, seem to have a lot of side effects. How is this drug tolerated?
In this setting, 5 milligrams daily was extremely well tolerated. There was no major problems. But of course, because of the experience with other drugs or even this drug in other clinical settings, one needs to be cautious. And for example, everybody is given Bactrim to prevent atypical infection. So you're not taking one drug, one pill. You're taking actually one drug for myelofibrosis and one antibiotic to prevent infections. Of course, it makes it a little bit complicated. Then you need to explain to the patients what's happening here. But nevertheless, if you can, in easy, safe way, improve the condition of the patients, as you can see here, without too much of worry, just extra antibiotic on top, it's still valuable.
Again, I know they're totally different, but you hear a lot about glucose intolerance with these agents in breast cancer. Do you see that here?
Very surprising. I think that it's a matter of the dose. It's chosen based on efficacy, of course, but also tolerability. And it's very low dose, 5 milligrams daily.
All right, please continue.
Now, if we are talking about, as we did so far, a second line, we talk about fedratinib second line, pacritinib, and then momelotinib. We said we can improve the front line by adding a pelabresib to people who are not doing well, how about starting with the best combination from day one, right? Early intervention with the best combination. So one approach is here to add navitoclax to ruxolitinib in people who are therapy naive. The phase 3 study is underway. The phase 2 study results that I show here are pretty good. You see the waterfall here to the left. That's a 35% volumetric reduction in spleen. The dotted line shows you that majority of the patients had improvement in the spleen. There was some improvement in the symptoms as well. One issue with this drug, navitoclax, is, which is BCL2 and BCL-XL inhibitor, by the way, is the thrombocytopenia. And thrombocytopenia, which is seen in the bars to the right, does compromise the delivery of the drug to some degree. It's not that simple. And I always talk about the value of any therapy in three terms: safety, efficacy, and simplicity. So sometimes some drugs are too complicated to give or require management style that you need to see the patients often. And that worries me a little bit with this drug. But still, if we want to improve our ability to control signs and symptoms, why not combine things from the day one, if at all possible? This is improvement in the bone marrow. I'll talk about this in a minute, but just to say the symptoms also improve with the navitoclax, and you always have to think about benefit in two arms. One is the spleen and the symptoms. It has to be together, always together. Now, what the emphasis of the ASH presentation of navitoclax plus ruxolitinib phase 2 study was not only to say, hey, it can improve the spleen and management is pretty okay. It also talked about what you see here, improvement in the bone marrow fibrosis. Okay, why is that? Well, in an intro to the discussion today, we were talking about perhaps upping the bar in ET and PV to start talking about the molecular response by decreasing the allele burden, the JAK2 allele burden in particular, and seeing whether this has any clinical relevance. And I'll come to that. What's happening in myelofibrosis, there is lots of emphasis, as you can see here, of an attempt to connect the bone marrow fibrosis grade decrease with the clinical benefit. Now, we are not there yet, but every single presentation at ASH, I would say almost every single one, had this particular information embedded.
So maybe very naive question, but again, I'm sure people are asking themselves this. How would you compare navitoclax to venetoclax, either pharmacologically or in any other way?
Excellent question. I was waiting for you to ask me. Why are we talking about the navitoclax? Now, you know, venetoclax is already out there. Why not just do it? Okay, the reason is biology. In the myeloproliferative neoplasms, the cells have high BCL2, but they also have high BCL-XL. And what does this mean is this venetoclax doesn't really work well. For venetoclax activity, you have high BCL2, but you should have a low BCL-XL. And in MPN, both are high. And this is very well established information, so much so that venetoclax, when it was studied in AML patients, the studies that led to approval of venetoclax excluded patients that came to AML from MPN. Post-MPN AML patients were not part of those studies because they still have a very high BCL-XL on top of BCL2, and the venetoclax does not work very well in patients with post-MPN AML. There are 5 papers at least so far that, yes, you can do it, and maybe the CR rate is a little bit higher when you combine it with hypomethylation agents, which would be standard practice therapy for post-MPN AML, but it's much more toxic, and the result, it doesn't last more than a month or two. We don't use, actually, venetoclax in post-MPN AML regularly unless there is very good reason. So that's why navitoclax, which is BCL2 and BCL-XL inhibitor, that is the drug that is being tested by the company that it makes the both drugs as the drug of choice in MPN. And it is working to a degree, of course, but it does cause some thrombocytopenia.
Does navitoclax work in AML after myelofibrosis? Navitoclax, HMA?
I hope there would be a study to that effect. I am aware of some discussion, but nothing concrete so far. And if you would ask me, I'm just one, I would use it. Yes, I would use navitoclax for post-MPN AML rather than venetoclax. But it's not possible, right? The drug is investigational.
So interesting. We just work with Courtney DiNardo. I wish I'd known this. I would have asked her. I had no idea. That's so interesting.
Yeah. We actually published a paper in Blood Advances last year on more than 30 patients with post-MPN AML that were given venetoclax from different studies and did not really work very well. No difference in survival between the hypomethylation agent alone versus hypomethylation and venetoclax. And it's just much toxic. You know, and more death from the sepsis, basically. So that's very why we stay away from that, if we can. Hmm. Let's move on to the next drug, which is pelabresib, a BET inhibitor, right? So BET or bromodomain inhibitor, it's really epigenetic modifier. And it's being tested in the same setting as the navitoclax, frontline setting. A combination of the two from the day one. And this is something that has been rising eyebrows for quite some time, perhaps more than navitoclax, because of the results that you can see here. This is, again, phase two study. You have a very good result in the spleen at 24 weeks to the left, and then best reduction spleen on the study at any point in time to the right. So you would not expect a result with the ruxolitinib alone to that degree. You also have improvement in the quality of life as well, and it appears to be very well tolerated. It is given 2 weeks on, 1 week off, because it does cause some thrombocytopenia. But the results from this study, open label phase two study, did not show such a difficulty in management of patients. So simplicity was preserved to a degree, and a blinded randomized phase three study of this combination versus ruxolitinib is underway, as is navitoclax combo versus ruxolitinib alone. So these are really competing head-to-head. And now we come to what I highlighted earlier on as extremely interesting. This is the monoclonal antibody that would target specifically mutant calreticulin. Just to perhaps quickly, briefly repeat, that would be genetic mutation. About 30% of MF and ET patients have that. This mutation would lead to mutated protein that is in Golgi apparatus, and then it's secreted outside the cell and it binds to the receptor for thrombopoietin, which is called MIPL. And that's how, through that receptor and binding to the receptor, activates the JAK-STAT pathway and drives the disease as an entity. So it's a driver mutation. This is how we save calreticulin, or JAK2 mutation, or a mutation in the MIPL itself. These are three mutually excluded mutations. So if it's on the surface of the cell, this is how it works. If it's on the surface of the cell, then you can devise a medication that would inhibit it. So if you look through the left here, you have a mutant calreticulin in the blue, right? You see here it's outside the cell. On the surface of the cell, it activates the JAK-STAT pathway. And here you have antibody already embedded in the cartoon. So anti-mutant calreticulin antibody would inhibit the activation of or dimerization of the receptors that is necessary for that hyperactivity or initiation of the activity of the JAK-STAT pathway. And that would lead, this is naked antibody, that would lead over time to a slow dying off of the malignant cells. So that has been done in mice, and we hope that we have that study open in people by the end of this year as a first ever calreticulin antibody-driven study for specific mutation-positive patients, calreticulin mutation-positive patients. Because look, in mice, it works, right? You can see here the cartoon here or pictures of those bone marrows in mice. So perhaps this is the first step. Can we envision bispecifics? Can we envision CAR T cells? I would hope so, but what are the limitations of this approach? We were talking earlier on, very early on, that there is an effect on the genetic mutation profile on what the JAK inhibitors do, because there might be other accessory pathways activated in these cells That's why we use PI3 kinase inhibitor. There might be other genetic abnormalities that lead to activation of other cells through genetic or epigenetic modification. Well, that's why we use epigenetic modifiers. BET inhibitor is just one of many epigenetic modifiers that have been tested. So all of this is extraordinarily attractive. And that's why it was plenary session. And people were lining up after the discussion, say, can I have the study open in my center? So enthusiasm is extraordinarily high. I don't know whether this will make in advanced myelofibrosis patients such a desirable benefit. Early intervention, again, makes sense to me. Once we are done with the phase one study and we know it's safe, you can start treating perhaps earlier phase patients to intervene early and in that setting, perhaps eliminate disease, prevent progression.
What fraction of patients have calreticulin mutations, and any reason to think it would work in the rest of the patients?
About a third of the patients have with myelofibrosis calreticulin mutation, and about a third of the ET patients. So the number is smaller. Perhaps you would like everybody to be candidate, but it should not be active for any other type of patients with ET or MF, because simply it's specific for that mutation. So it's attractive for a subgroup of patients. And in that subgroup, we need to see how good that is going to be. Just by logic, I would say earlier intervention matters, but then you need really to go through the full drug development path and make sure it's safe in more advanced patients, see whether there is an activity in genetically complicated disease with big spleen and symptoms and anemia, and then move it up front perhaps, or even in ET patients that have a calreticulin in that setting as well. ET are, you know, different ball game here. ET patients are one with a good quality of life, typically normal life expectancy, and it would be a question, based on the results from the myelofibrosis studies, which ET patients would be candidate among those that have calreticulin mutation, candidate for this antibody. On the other hand, this is naked antibody. It should not have any side effects that are associated, for example, with the bispecifics or CAR T cells. So it should be easy, like once a month infusion. How about ET patient with calreticulin give 1 month infusion, and after 2 years of therapy, slowly you get CR, complete molecular response, no disease anymore. Wonderful story. I hope to see it in my lifetime.
I hope to hear more about it in the next year. Do you think we're going to see humans receive this drug in the next year?
Well, by the end of this year, I hope the study is going to open. And so by 2024, December, we should have some preliminary result. I certainly hope so.
Please continue.
Okay. Moving on to different disease, polycythemia vera. You may recall that polycythemia includes high red blood cell. Of course, everybody does that. And knows that, then the white cells and platelets, but also control the spleen and symptoms. So when we talk of about benefits of any therapy, if you give a cytoreduction therapy, you should be looking at the five factors: control of red blood cells, platelets, white cells, spleen, and symptoms. And ruxolitinib was approved as a second-line choice after hydroxyurea. And here is a study done in UK. This is academically driven study, not a company-driven study, where they were looking at the benefits beyond controlling the spleen symptoms, red blood cells, white cells, and platelets. They were saying, is there a molecular response? If it is, does it matter? Now, you would say, how can this even be, right? The JAK inhibitors that we talked so far about are not specific for the JAK mutation. That I hope everybody knows. You don't need to have a specific mutation. You don't even need to test the patient for molecular profile to prescribe a JAK inhibitor for patients that need control the signs and symptoms, right? It will work. But it can, over a long period of time, inhibit the growth of the malignant cells more than normal, because the malignant cells depend much more on a continuously active or hyperactive JAK-STAT pathway. So we have seen that after a longer period of time, and you don't have that time in myelofibrosis field, unfortunately, but in ET and PV, you can. Or you could see after a longer period of time molecular response. And here we go. You see molecular response. It's called a 50% reduction in the allele burden for the JAK2 And it's seen in more than half of ruxolitinib patients and about a quarter of the best available therapy, which can be interferon, hydroxyurea, or anything, whatever the doctor wants to do. This is, again, done in UK, not driven by the company. So it's a standard practice, best available therapy. And you can see in a graph in a right upper corner, event-free survival by molecular response. What is event-free survival, right? That is the lack of a progression to myelofibrosis, having a clot or AML or bleeding. And if you look at the table in the right lower corner, you would see that the response, in particular in ruxolitinib arm, molecular response has been associated statistically significant with less of a thromboembolic events, hemorrhagic events, progression, or event in general, and overall survival. That's why I am very fond of this type of long-term studies that eventually may lead us to reassess what the goals of therapy in PV are, because nobody really tests for this in everyday practice. It's not normal practice to do molecular testing or even to look at the allele burden. This is two-step. One is to say, is there a JAK mutation? And then what is the allele burden? Nobody does that. But this type of studies eventually may lead us to start thinking about that and judge not only the drug based on ability to control the CBC or the spleen or symptoms, but also is there an extra benefit in the molecular response? Unfortunately, this is now going to genetic complexity. I mean, how many times did I mention the genetic complexity? There are other mutations even in PV that can happen, not as often as is myelofibrosis, and presence of other mutations is not good. And it does affect in a negative way overall response. You can see this in a graphs at the bottom, like say in the bottom in the middle, it says event-free survival by the number of driver mutations. And then event-free survival by SX1 in particular in the right lower corner, those patients, not too many, that have SX1 mutation don't do well. So genetic complexity again has a role even in the quote-unquote benign condition, and it does affect the benefit of the therapy. Similar presentation from Italy. The first one was from UK. This was back-to-back oral presentations saying that, yes, in PV and this setting also ET, that molecular response is of value. These are the definitions of the response, perhaps easier to conceptually see. Partial is 50% decrease in allele burden. They call it deep response rate when the allele burden goes below 2% and a complete undetectable. That's not very common, but it's possible. And no response, of course, nothing really happens. Here is the summary. This is the most visually appealing. You can see very well. Green line, no change from the beginning. CMR, complete molecular response, and deep molecular response. Few patients, not too many, but no progression, right? No progression. And those that did not have a molecular response in red color, obviously they do worse. So if you combine these two presentations, you can certainly easily understand the concept where there is now quite a significant incentive for those that are providing the guidelines to perhaps incorporate molecular monitoring in everyday management of ET and PV patients. But that will require a lot from the involved providers to think about molecular response, have a test available, and then interpret it. And that's my the greatest worry. If we up the bar and say you should monitor for molecular response and only minority have a molecular response, then I would worry that the doctor or a patient, particularly patient, would say, I know my numbers are excellent and my thrombotic risk, blood clotting risk is controlled well by having a good blood count. I'm not responding because I don't have a molecular response. I want something else. Well, that's the bad side of the success, right? Of starting to talk about molecular response. So it may be perhaps too much to start doing this type of testing at the moment in everyday practice. And I do not do it regularly in my own clinic either. This is still part of the exploration and clinical studies. Now, in ET, we had a presentation that I just finished of a long-term use of ruxolitinib ET in addition to PV. But first one needs to say that ruxolitinib is not approved for ET. What we have here is information from clinical studies. This is one of the those studies that was also presented in oral session. You see here essential thrombocythemia. And in this setting, the ruxolitinib was compared to best available therapy. Different drugs, again, driven by the good willing doctors in Germany in particular, not company sponsored. So any best available therapy might have been used. You can see those endpoints that are typically looked at. You can see platelet count, hemoglobin, white cells, and the spleen. These are the goals, right? As it's for PV was CBC and the spleen and symptoms. In ET, it's platelets, white cells, and the spleen, and you do not want to cause much of anemia. So here there are some differences, but not extraordinary to brag about it. And that's actually is in part a reason why there is no approved ruxolitinib for ET. It is harder to control the platelets with ruxolitinib. You need a very high dose, 25 milligrams twice a day. Then it can cause anemia. And if you try to balance it, then it's not that much, somewhat, but not extraordinary much better than best available therapy. It does improve the symptoms, no question about it. If there is a drug for symptomatic ET patient that is not doing well on standard cytoreduction reduction therapy, then ruxolitinib is the drug to go to. That would be off-label in the United States. But yes, for quality of life issues, you can see multiple different symptoms here in this graph. And all these stars are clinically and statistically significant results that makes a day and night for involved patients. So I have asked insurance to, in some cases with ET, give me an approval for ruxolitinib when the patient suffers from the symptoms and hydroxyurea or interferon or anagrelide are not really good. Interferon is not even approved, so you have a hydroxyurea and anagrelide. They're not that good for the symptoms. If the patient suffers from the symptoms, ruxolitinib is something they ask for. There is a possibility of developing a new drug in ET as well. And here is one of the examples. This is the LSD1 inhibitor. What is the LSD1 inhibitor? That is another epigenetic modifier. We mentioned epigenetic modification with the BET inhibitor earlier on, which was pelabresib. Pelabresib is being tested in ET. It did not mature enough yet for a presentation, but this one, bomedestat, is something that caught an eye of many doctors at ASH as active in ET. Just briefly, what do we do in ET? We certainly look first for the reason for introduced cytoreduction therapy. If we decide to do something, then we do hydroxyurea, and then we do anagrelide. The guidelines usually say you can use interferon, but there is no approved interferon. There is a study underway, however, to complement what I'm going to talk about in a second. There is a study underway comparing ropeg interferon, which is approved for PV in the United States since November 2021, ropeg interferon versus anagrelide in the second-line setting for control of the platelets and the white cells, which may be sometimes high in ET patients, for possible approval of interferon. So perhaps in a couple of years, we'll have a ropeg interferon approved for ET. But the new agents are coming. And here is a pill. That's a pill, bomedestat. It does lower the platelets, you can see. 9 out of 10 patients will have a durable, which is 3 months or more, control of the platelet count below 400, which is very good, 90%. It has, unfortunately, some issues with side effects. By the way, in addition to controlling the platelets, it does lower the white cells, which is important. We said control the platelets, white cells, spleen, and symptoms are the factors that matter, not just the platelets. And of course, then simplicity and safety. And here we have little issues. You can see some side effects that are not that friendly for continuous lifelong therapy, dysgeusia, constipation, some arthralgias and fatigue, and so on. So that's what concerns me a little bit here. no question that it's attractive. We'll see whether it's going to be safe and simple enough for further development, because you have a hydroxyurea, anagulide, and possibly ropic interferon. Is there a room for another drug in this setting? It's being tested. We'll see. I'm looking forward to new drugs in ET as well. So maybe here I'm going to talk a little bit more about BMS, BET inhibitor. We talk about pelabresib as the BET inhibitor. There are others. And why test others, right? Look, I was involved with the 11 different JAK inhibitors so far, and we had ruxolitinib, fedratinib, pacritinib, and now momelotinib possibly approved, and they're not the same, right? A classic example of testing so many to get best out of them, and it's not only about one. Now we're going to possibly have four. Why not more of the BET inhibitors or more of the BCL-XL inhibitors or any of these that I mentioned so far? And so there is a room. This is a BET inhibitor that is in earlier stage, when 1-2 is showing promise. Again, this is a study that is underway. Some early study results seen here to the left of spleen volume reduction as an example of improvements are encouraging. And because we need to test more than one to get to the best BET inhibitor, and I'm sure there will be one approved at the end, because it's active, they give it a chance, right? And there are other companies that are doing their own BET inhibitors in the space. So this is just an example of how active this field has become. We are discovering multiple different areas of abnormalities in the malignant cells that lead us to different drugs. BET inhibitor, BCL-XL inhibitor, we have telomerase inhibitors, we have a variety of different drugs. So I was pleased to see four oral presentations on MPN this year. Even one presentation as a part of plenary session, as we discussed. When you compare this to 15 years ago, there was none. I'm not kidding. You just look back. So the field has evolved so much. It's incredible to just grasp what happened over the last 15 years. And it's been now 12 years since the approval of ruxolitinib, and fourth drug it's going to be approved probably by the summer for myelofibrosis. And over the next 3 to 5 years, I would think there will be another 3 or 4 drugs. We're going to start talking about doubles. We're going to maybe triplets, so doublets and triplets, not just the lines of therapy, but subgroups of different therapies. It's just going to be amazing, I tell you. Exciting time.
It's going to be the new myeloma, it sounds like.
Yeah. Everybody's saying, oh, we are getting to the myeloma field. I say, well, it's good and bad, right? I would like to have a therapies like that antibody or similar therapies that would up the bar and say CR. Hey, I give you this in 6 months, you are in CR and it works forever. Of course, if I was about to say that 15 years ago, people would look at me funny and say, you are crazy. I'm not crazy anymore, right? So it's doable. But the first priority is to just optimize what we do with all these drugs and perhaps just make people live longer and normal life expectancy as a goal, even with the disease under control. Do you really need to eliminate it? Maybe not.
So one more question. I just thought of this, and I don't remember asking anybody this, but I think maybe I will start asking it. And that question is, if someone who had a lot of funding came to you, you know, grateful patient, you know, tech billionaire or something, unlimited budget for you to deal with MPN, what would you do?
If you have somebody in mind, after the call, you can talk about
it. You never know, never know. But maybe, I mean, what would you do? You know, really, you know, kind of move the field forward faster than it's going right now. Let's put it that way.
As a concept, we have been so far preoccupied with the intervention. And of course, in that regard, that's a priority, right? People sick, you need to intervene and help them. And then we talk about first line and the second line and the anemia and the spleen and symptoms. And this is what we have been doing, and we made strides. How about in prevention studies? You know, prevention studies. Early on, low risk prefibrotic myelofibrosis, ETPV that show some sign of progression, something to give them to prevent progression. And this would really make it as chronically possible forever. Let's say you have a low risk patient, that means no anemia, no symptoms, no spleen, nothing wrong, accidental finding, touch of anemia or touch of a spleen, that's low risk patient. What do we do today? We wait. We wait for patients to become sick, and then we treat for the anemia or spleen or whatever it's affecting the patient's quality of life. How about we have a medication, maybe that antibody will be one, where we say, oh, how about you take this pill? You don't need to worry. The spleen or the anemia or anything will not worsen. We don't need to eliminate it, but we prevent progression. So I would like to have the opportunity to work a person like that to see how can we optimize the current medications or devise new medications to move the focus from prevention, from intervention to prevention.
Anything exciting that we've learned about the etiology? And since you bring up prevention, the etiology of the disease and what the implications might be, you know, one of the things, I don't know, again, I'm way far out just sort of watching this from the outside. In a way, it kind of seems like we're trying to move the bar a little bit further, a little bit farther. I'm not sure how much that's because of, you know, sort of the industry motivation, et cetera. But do you think that we should be looking for more home runs?
We should. Better the response, CR, will definitely then lead to elimination of any symptoms, spleen or anemia, right? Everything is normal. But we were not able to do that so far with medications that are in pipelines. They are not really specific for malignant clone. The inability to devise a specific inhibitor of JAK2 mutation, for example, or medications that would intervene in the bone marrow environment to prevent fibrosis progression. You may recall we had some antifibrotic medications in the pipeline as well at this time. None of these really pan out. There is now a lot of talk about being more aggressive in finding the medications that will be specific, and first sign is this antibody for calreticulin, but that's, again, a smaller group of people. If you would have a JAK2 mutation-specific drug, maybe you will have a major impact on the disease overall. And if it's safe enough, you do then intervene earlier on to prevent progression. So these issues are coupled together. You're correct. We are still at the, not to be too harsh, but at the level where we are really talking about the symptoms, spleen and anemia, and we are not talking about molecular response, elimination of the disease and cure, not at all. So as we talk about upping the bar, well, that's tied to the drugs, which would be potentially leading to those, and we don't have them yet. So it's coupled, and I think it's in everybody's interest. I don't blame anybody for this. It is just a very difficult condition, the disease, myelofibrosis in particular, that it's not that easy, and it's not that anybody from the industry or from the academia has a lack of enthusiasm and desire or passion to develop those drugs. It's just hard.
Have there been antibodies to JAK?
It's never expressed on the surface. So the JAK2 mutation is staying inside the cell, and it's not subject to antibodies. That's the problem. And when I ask over the last almost now 20 years since the JAK2 mutation was discovered, why don't we have a TKI for the JAK2 mutation? Well, they said biochemically this is very difficult. I can't really explain the reasons, but many tried, and it has not happened so far.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Verstovsek, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.